What I wanted to do with this session is I wanted to take everyone back, if they can, back to just prior to and through the deepest, darkest days of the GFC, and go on that journey through the GFC to where we are today. And the hope that I have is through some robust discussion with our panel today, is to explore what is the new norm. Is the environment which we are in today the new norm? Or is it in fact, hope that we will return to those days of pre the GFC? And a good way of kicking that off, I think, is to ask Malcolm Eadie. Malcolm, if you could give us some insights into the RBA during what I'll call dark days, into the war room, as it were, of the RBA, and walk us through some of the policy responses and some of the challenges that the RBA faced through that time.
Okay, thanks very much. Yes, they were very dramatic times, and as you know, the Reserve Bank has a very central role in these matters because of our macroeconomic policy role, our monetary policy function, and also because of our general responsibility for financial system stability. During the time of the financial crisis, I was the head of the economics group of the Reserve Bank, and I can well remember watching the numbers come in showing really very dramatic plunges in international trade, production and global activity. It was clear that it was a serious global recession and there was some very severe dislocation in financial markets. There are parts of the Reserve Bank that are responsible for our market operations, which deal with the provision of liquidity to the banks, and they were very much at the forefront of ensuring that the banking system had adequate liquidity to cope during the times of most severe disruption. I think as we look back on it, we can now see that the Australian economy did very well by comparison with other developed countries around the world. We use the shorthand that this was a GFC, a global financial crisis. We can see now that it was mainly a crisis of the United States and Europe. Those were the countries where the really severe dislocation in financial markets originated. They were also the countries that went into the most severe recession and that experienced the most severe stress on their financial systems and which required large sums of public money to go in to recapitalise the banks. If you think about some of the gross numbers that summarise what went on, a few numbers that I like to highlight. At the height of the international downturn, the US economy contracted by 4%, the euro area contracted by 5%, the UK contracted by 6%. These were the most severe recessions that those economies have had in the post-war period. Australia, by contrast to that, even though our growth rate did slow down, it remained positive. Growth slowed to a trough of about positive 1% and then picked up to a rate back around trend fairly quickly after that. The Australian banks didn't need public funds to bail them out and recapitalise them. Banks did suffer some reduction in profitability, but that's very different from what was experienced in the US and Europe, where banks made major losses and needed public funds to bail them out. So, to get back to your original question, it was a very dramatic event at the time. Australia did come through it in a lot better shape than most, but we weren't by any means immune from the international distress, and I guess as this session goes on, we might talk a bit more about the effects that the post-crisis environment is having on the banking system, the availability of finance to the economy.
Malcolm, in terms of policy setting with the RBA, because we are a floating rate environment here in Australia, predominantly for people, be it household borrowers, corporates, or real estate, commercial real estate, in terms of a policy setting, it's always intrigued me. We're among friends, you can be open here. What's the kind of discussion that goes on around trying to balance expectations in the marketplace? Because if you talk the market down enough, and what happens is people respond and they don't spend, as we heard in earlier discussions. They don't spend, so the RBA doesn't have to respond with policy settings that would otherwise be needed to counteract any spending. Is what weight's given to that in policy discussion?
Well, as you know, the policy process has to be forward-looking, so it's always based on an assessment of the economic outlook, and our assessment of the outlook has to take into account the way people are reacting to the things that we might be saying as well. I think it's probably not productive to tie ourselves up into too many knots about what we think they're thinking about, what we're going to do, and all those sorts of things. I think when the RBA is communicating to the public, the main thing we're trying to do is just to give people the most realistic assessment we can as to our current thinking, and that necessarily has to evolve over time as new information becomes available. So that's really what's going on.
Well, foreign banks fed the machine last time round. Malcolm, I read with interest that foreign banks are active again in Australia's shores, and APRA's taken, I don't know, something like 20 applications for banking licences here in Australia. Are they the sort of bankers that we're going to see participating in the real estate market from your observation, or are they here for specific relationship reasons?
It's very hard to know. I think that there's going to be some re-internationalisation in the banking industry. There's been a period of consolidation, of pullback in risk in the immediate aftermath of the crisis, and so I think we're now seeing some relaxation of attitudes towards risk-taking. People are exploring new markets across borders, so I think we're seeing some of that, but I can't really comment on specific business strategies of new entrants.
Sure. Malcolm, the presumption in that third question is that the RBA does talk down the market outlook for the Australian property market. I must say that's personally not been my observation of the RBA. I think there are enough people talking down the prospects for the Aussie property market, be it residential or commercial, without the RBA chiming in. I mean, your response?
Thank you. Yes, obviously somebody's unhappy with something that we've said. I don't think we're consciously trying to talk down the property sector or any sector of the Australian economy. It is a reality that the property sector is highly cyclical. We've always known that, and it's just been through a cycle. As Mark just said, it's been actually a much more mild cycle than some of the earlier ones that we've seen, and a number of indicators now actually are on the improve. Aggregate vacancy rates are looking better. Price indicators in the property sector are looking better, and particularly if you compare it with the situation in, say, the US or some of the European countries where still they've got massive overhangs of excessive building, prices still falling. By comparison with those sorts of cases, our property sector actually is in good shape. So we're not trying to talk it down. We've made the general point in Australia that the economy has been growing close to trend over the last year or two, and the unemployment rate is low. We do have a very significant amount of investment, particularly driven by the resource sector, coming through and still to come. And so these are all things that we have to balance against each other as we think about the outlook for the economy. And perhaps what the questioner might be referring to is that we have made the general point in Australia that if the economy is already at a high level of employment, and we know there are significant expansions in some parts of the economy still to come, well, that will make it harder for other parts to grow as fast as they normally do. That's just the nature of reality. All sectors can't grow faster than average all the time. But I think probably I can't really say much more about that question, but as you've said, I don't think we're particularly trying to talk down the property sector, as the question implies.
From a regulatory standpoint, Malcolm, I mean, are there any sort of big, you know, hairy impediments out there that you can see to non-bank participants? And it's probably more from APRA's perspective than the RBA. But you know, you are constantly in communication with the major banks, obviously, as part of the policy role of the RBA. Is a non-bank lending market something we should even aspire to here in Australia? I'm reminded of a discussion I had with the head of real estate investment banking at one of the big US banks. So it was, you know, either a JP Morgan or a Morgan Stanley. And in 2006, so we had a meeting with them in San Francisco, and they wanted us to go and do this great new CDO. And his final words were, "We love this. This is unregulated banking." And look at where it got them. Mm. So, there's a desire, I think, on the part of real estate participants to see a diversified source of debt capital. Is that something that maybe a question for you, Mark? I mean, you know, you don't necessarily welcome competition, you know, in many respects, but if it can lead to a more diversified and a more stable industry, isn't that a good outcome for everyone?
No, I agree. I think the more competition, I think the better, the stronger the sector will be. I think the key things people need to consider, though, is the sustainability of the source of income or the source of capital that they're getting. There's lots of markets that can be tapped offshore. That will definitely come back. One of the learnings from the GFC is where people had access capital from sources during the good times, perhaps that source of capital wasn't there when times were a little bit tough. And that comes back to that handle-on, handle-off scenario I talked about before. So I agree that there needs to be diversity of funding. People need to have the right diversity of funding. They need to have the right profile of funding. And provided that you are forming relationships with good, stable counterparties that you can have a good relationship with and deal with through time, over time, we're all for it. I think it's very good.
And from a regulatory standpoint, Malcolm?
Well, I think the question we have to ask ourselves as regulators is, are there unnecessary impediments that are stopping a market from developing? What is it that's stopping these markets that you're interested in from coming into existence or expanding? I think the main things that are actually stopping that is risk aversion by investors. The whole post-crisis environment is really an environment where investors are more averse to debt, and it's an environment of deleveraging. So I think in that environment, it's already hard for new debt-based markets to grow. Having said that, I think there was excessive risk aversion in things like securitisation markets, and we've seen at least a partial normalisation as people have got used to the post-crisis environment, and so maybe we'll see some more of that coming along. People sometimes ask whether super funds have investment strategies that are overweight in equities or overweight in offshore investments, but if they do, and I'm not going to express a view on that, but if they do, I don't think that's driven by the unintended consequences of some regulation that shouldn't be there. It's driven by the choices that are being made by fund managers. I think also if you're thinking about what fund managers can do if they're managing a super fund. Well, they have to, in a world where governments are trying to encourage increased mobility of super fund membership, fund managers need to worry about the liquidity of their investments, and so it's not all just about return, and that's another factor that needs to be taken into account.
Looking at these questions, the speed of the market, two or three, as somebody postured this morning, and the Reserve Bank's current monetary policy settings. Looking at it, I guess the question there is, would you like more levers, Malcolm, to manage, the environment in which we find ourselves at the moment?
Thanks. Yes, I was going to say this is the easiest question I've ever had. Is the Reserve Bank strategy appropriate? Yes.
Why did I know you were going to say that?
Next question.
We know that different parts of the economy grow at different speeds. That's normal. It happens all the time. It can be different sectors of the economy. Different types of spending can be growing faster or slower than the others. Different geographical regions. It's not that long ago that people used to complain that the Reserve Bank was very focused on New South Wales and Victoria. Well, New South Wales was regarded as the fast-growing part of the Australian economy, and we were forgetting the rest, and now we're being told we're forgetting New South Wales and allowing policy to be driven by the fast-growing resource states. The fact is we've got one instrument, which is the policy interest rate, and we have to set that based on the aggregate for the national economy. That's the way things are. But I think having acknowledged that parts of the economy are growing at different speeds, the truth is unemployment is low everywhere, so it's not... it's misleading to say that some parts of Australia are completely missing out. There's prosperity across the country. Unemployment is low everywhere. Employment has been growing everywhere. If there are parts that are really seriously in hardship, well, that's a matter for fiscal policy. There are fiscal instruments that can target areas that are in difficulty, but monetary policy, as I said, it's one instrument. It has to be targeted at the national aggregate.
We did have one question around the GST. And look, I don't know. Do we know enough about the carbon tax and the implementation thereof to get a view about inflation? I personally don't have a view.
Yeah, I might just make one comment on that. I think the parallel with the GST, I think, is quite relevant because the concept that we tried to put out at the time was you have to distinguish between a change in the price level and an increase in the ongoing inflation rate. At the time of the GST, the price level went up by a bit over 2%. But people were well educated to understand that there would be compensation paid back in the form of increased benefits, tax cuts, that would leave people on average no worse off and in many cases better off in terms of their real incomes. People understood that, and so the rise in the price level back then didn't feed into ongoing wage claims and therefore into the inflation rate. Once that one-off adjustment had taken place. I think we should expect something similar to happen here. It's a price level effect. It's not something that keeps being repeated year after year. Compensation will be paid, and as long as people understand that, and they understand that therefore it doesn't need to feed into ongoing wage claims and price expectations, we should expect something similar to happen in this case. And the scale of it, in fact, is significantly less than occurred under the GST.
Thanks, Malcolm. Look, we've got three quick questions there. We might hit on these very quickly. Perhaps starting with the second one, underemployment versus unemployment. I read yesterday that there is the recent study says that we need by 2020 1.6 million additional workers in Australia. 400 to 500,000 of those are required in West Australia alone. A view, perhaps from you, Malcolm, in terms of underemployment versus unemployment, and you know, how is that reflected in the casual labour market?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what this question is getting at. There are various measures of that try to pick up whether people are available to work, if they're working part-time, whether they're available to work more hours, or if they're shown as unemployed, are they? How hard are they looking for work, and so on. I think what those measures show is that when you track the aggregate tightness of the labour market using those broader measures of underemployment, they give you very much the same picture of the way the business cycle is affecting the labour market. So I don't think we need to rethink the way that we understand labour market conditions. I think the broad picture at the moment is that the level of employment is high, and really, you know, when we compare ourselves with other advanced countries, we should be thankful that we've actually had such a strong performance over recent years, and that we've got low unemployment right around the country.